Well, we're thinking, as I said, about knowing Jesus and making him known. And we have that picture on the screen, a beautiful picture which Anthony found for us with the cross and the sun shining through the cross. Knowing Jesus and making him known. Last week, we read John chapter 1 and we read the invitation to come and see. Come and see, said Jesus. Come and know Jesus. We read the five names of Jesus in that passage, the end of chapter 1 of John's Gospel. We've thought about how there's always more to discover when we think about knowing Jesus. We're never finished with knowing Jesus. There's always more to learn and discover. And we're on a journey, we're on an adventure through John's Gospel, which we will continue over the next few weeks and months. And we'll find there's so much there to learn and to know about Jesus. Come and see Jesus. Come and make him known. We read last week about the five people in that passage. They came to Jesus in different ways, each one of them. No set pattern that we have to stick to. And over the next few months, as I've said, we're going to be hearing one another's stories, as we heard at Myra's story this morning. We'll hear about how we came to know Jesus in all sorts of different ways, and that'll be great to hear. But there's a challenge as well in that passage from John 1 that we read last week, that how we are those who offer this invitation to other people, not with all the answers in an arrogant sort of way, but gently and openly, just saying to people, you know, I've found something here. Come and see what it is that I've found. Come and see Jesus. Come and see him. Come and meet him. And today we're in John chapter 2, and Jesus has gone to a wedding. And we're going to think about the title, Come and Receive. Last week, come and see. This week, come and receive. I want to ask you, what is the most memorable wedding you've ever been to? I wonder, what is the most memorable? Maybe it was memorable because of who was involved. Maybe it was your wedding. Maybe something happened at the wedding and everybody talks about it ever since. Maybe something went wrong at the wedding. Well, at our wedding, a family member, not one here today, and one who will remain anonymous, made a bit of a memorable moment at the wedding by the grace, saying prayers before our meal. And the thing was, he, in all honesty, he hadn't prepared what he was going to say. And so he stood up and just started to pray, and he ended up getting into a bit of a corner because he said something like this. He said something like this, Lord, we pray for Pete and Liz, pray that they would be happy together until they die. And he had nowhere else to go except there, got himself in literally a dead end, I suppose. And we laughed about it, and it became part of our memory of that day, a happy day, and that was sort of a funny memory. The famous wedding grace. You shouldn't invite him to say grace at your wedding, the lesson. But at this wedding, in John chapter 2, where Jesus turns up to this wedding, there's a much more serious problem about to happen. If you want to follow, it's on page 1064 of the Church Bibles. And a much, much more serious problem is about to develop. Because in the times of Jesus, weddings weren't just one afternoon or one day. They went on for days, usually 5 or 6 or 7 days. And people would have come from miles around to this wedding. And it was the responsibility of the groom to provide food and, crucially, wine for this wedding party. And if he failed, well, this will be a shameful failure to provide for your honoured guests. It would be the kind of shame that would stick. Now, Cana is a small village and it's in a rural area in Galilee. And people would know this story for generations to come. They would talk to one another. You remember that wedding? You know, the one in the one where the wine ran out. Oh, I remember that. That was what, 1979, wasn't it? Years ago that this wedding happened, people would remember because it would have been the kind of shame that would strip away all of the joy from that day that should have been all about celebration. It'd be the kind of shame that would leave deep and lasting wounds for those people involved, that family. And so when Jesus' mother comes to Jesus in verse 3 of our reading, when she says to him, "They've no more wine," this is a far more serious situation than simply running out of supplies. Actually, what's happening here is the joy of the day was about to finish. Failure was about to break out. The party was about to end in spectacularly bad fashion. And in what follows, I want to suggest we learn at least three things about Jesus. And we're thinking about knowing Jesus and making him known. Well, what does this little story tell us about who Jesus is and what he came to do? Well, firstly, I think it shows us that Jesus affirms ordinary things. You notice that, verses 1 and 2. Jesus was at a wedding party. An ordinary, sort of everyday event that you or I are sometimes invited to. And maybe sometimes we're led to believe that Jesus sort of floated around on a cloud, preaching detached sermons to groups of people, steering clear of the messy reality of life, and talking about mainly religious questions with mainly religious people. Well, next week, Jesus goes somewhere religious when we read about the temple, and he causes chaos when he gets there. He does go to religious places, and he causes trouble there. Jesus is certainly not safe, detached, or removed. He affirms ordinary things. He goes to ordinary places. He meets ordinary people. And here he is at a wedding party. Let's note, he's not in charge of the wedding party. He's just a guest, sat at the back of the room, eating, drinking, talking, part of the ordinariness of that daily life and the daily pattern of what was happening in that place. And it reminds us that ordinary things matter. They matter. Food, drink, relationships, shame, honor. Ordinary things. It's where most of us live most of our lives. It's where Jesus lived most of his life. In ordinary, the ordinariness of normal daily life, it matters to God. It matters to us. It matters to other people. So here's the lesson. Let's not leave Jesus in church when we go home today. Let's not leave Jesus in church. Let's not imagine that Jesus only has something to say about religious questions, about church organization, about ethical dilemmas. Actually, Jesus has plenty to say about our family life, about our workplace, about our sport, our recreation, our shopping, our food, our friendships, our planning, our budgeting, all of these things. Let's not leave Jesus in church when we go home today. And maybe we could take this on as a challenge for this coming week, and I'll do this too, to make a conscious effort this week to be alert to Jesus in the ordinary things of our lives. On the bus, posting a letter, meeting a friend when we're stuck in traffic, doing a boring part of our daily jobs. To ask ourselves, where is Jesus here? And how might I share Jesus here with those around me in this ordinary moment of my life? As Myra was talking earlier about how she speaks to people at coffee stop or speaks to people outside her house, and those kind of moments of ordinariness that Jesus here affirms. Secondly, Jesus involves left out people. You notice that Jesus at this wedding, his reply to his mother was a bit odd, wasn't it? Do you see that in verse 3? "Woman, why do you involve me?" That probably sounds ruder than it should. We might say, "dear woman." It wasn't disrespectful as a word. But it is a bit formal for your own mother. And Jesus actually uses the same word when he's on the cross in John chapter 19, verse 26, and he says, son, look after, he says to John to look after his mother, and to his mother, this is your son. The same word that he uses here. So maybe John is deliberately connecting those two things. But John said, Jesus says, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come. And when we read that word hour in John's gospel, it means one of two things. Either a time of suffering that will pass, or a moment of decisive change. And for John and for Jesus in this gospel, his hour, those two things, the suffering and decisive change, come together on the cross when Jesus dies, suffers, dies, and is resurrected. And Jesus knows that hour hasn't yet come. And so we might be thinking at this point in the story, things aren't looking good for this wedding and their supply problem. But that's not how Jesus' mother takes it, is it? You see what she says in verse 5? Turns to the servants and she says, do whatever he tells you. Do whatever he tells you. Somehow, she's got the idea that far from turning down her request, Jesus is about to jump in. And of course, she's right. Jesus does so, importantly, by involving left out people. Do you notice that? How does Jesus sort out this problem? He doesn't burst in like the superhero. I was thinking about this. If you've seen Harry Potter, in the banqueting hall at Hogwarts, when they have a banquet going on, Dumbledore stands up, sort of clicks his fingers, and the food just comes down from the sky onto the table. And it's just all there suddenly. And this guy has done it. Well, that's not how Jesus does it. Not at all. He involves the left out people. Verse 7, he tells the servants, fill the jars with water. They get to work. What do you think they thought? What? Fill the... What? What's this guy thinking? Doesn't he realize the problem is there's no wine, not that there's no water, but, you know, well, Mary told us to do whatever he said, so let's do whatever he said. So they obey, they do it. And then verse 8, what do you think they thought when he told them this? Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. They must have thought, now he's gone completely. What, you expect me to walk up to the most important guy in the whole place with a cup of tap water? He's going to think I've gone crazy. What's going on? But they obey, they do it. And then I love this detail in the story. Do you notice this man who read it for us? The master of the banquet tastes the wine and he's amazed. It's the best wine. And he says this, he did not realize where it had come from. But the servants who had drawn the water knew. Don't you love that? The important person, he didn't know. The powerful person didn't know. The master, those in charge, they didn't know. The servants knew. Those who are left out, those who are pushed to the edge, the marginalized, the ignored, the overlooked and the underpaid, they knew where it had come from. And Jesus seems to delight, doesn't he, in involving the left out people. People like me and people like you. Paul said this in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things to shame the strong. And I hope that as you hear that this morning, you feel encouraged that Jesus involves left out people like me and like you. And maybe there's a challenge for us about our attitude to those who are left out. Because sometimes, often, we prefer to mix with, to spend time with, to have the attention of the powerful people, those who are in charge, the masters. We prefer their attention quite often. But Jesus involves the left out people. Now, this real junk food project thing we've got happening here on Friday. I think this is a Jesus-like activity because everybody is fed. No one is privileged. Doesn't matter how much money you have. Doesn't matter. Pay as you feel. People are valued as people. Any contribution is welcomed, is valid. Come on Friday, let's see how that goes. Jesus affirms the ordinary things. He involves the left out people. Finally, Jesus provides abundant help. Look at verse 6, if you've still got the passage open. Verse 6 on page 1064 of our church Bibles. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 80 to 120 liters. That's a big bottle, a big jar. Maybe there's a hint in the reference to ceremonial washing. Maybe they're making some kind of point about how Jesus washes, provides for washing, which is more effective than this old method. But I think mostly these jars are talked about just to show why it is that these huge water containers were there. I could ask Roger to help me out here because we don't probably have much idea of what these jars look like. We don't have any in our church, ceremonial washing jars. It's not something that we do. But people reading this and hearing this first time would have been quite familiar with the idea. They would know what one of these looks like. So I thought I'll bring something similar, not asking anyone to get washed, by the way, to have a look at. If you pop it on here, Roger. This is it's not really a water jar, but it will do for our purposes today. I can get the top off. And it's a strength test to get it out. There we go. It's big. It's big. And this is our water. And I'll put that in there. It barely covers the bottom of the jar. Now, I don't know how much wine you would drink on a standard occasion or other non-alcoholic beverage, but you get quite a bit out of this jar. Quite a lot. And there wasn't one of these. There were six. There were six. And I think this is the point that the story is making to us. The point is, this is a lot of wine. A lot of wine. And in fact, this is far more wine than would be needed for any wedding party. Any wedding party, no matter where you're from. Far more. Far more. And Jesus performs this miracle. Jesus does this for a reason, to show us something about who he is and what he's come to do, to point to something. He didn't turn water into wine so that people got drunk at a wedding party. He did it to save the shame of the family, to rescue that wedding party from being somewhere that people talked about for years because of how awful it was, to something that people talked about for years because of how wonderful it was. Do you remember that with the quality of the wine and how much there was? My God, there was loads. They were drinking it for years afterwards. That's the story. Jesus changed the story. It was going to be one thing, and Jesus turned it around. Turned the disaster into joy. Turned the brokenness into wholeness. With such a display, they filled it, did you notice? They filled it to the brim. It must have taken them ages. Bringing little buckets in and filling this up. Six. It must have been there for ages, wasn't they? Doing that. Filling it right to the brim. How many, they think, perhaps 1,000 bottles of wine. That's a whole shop. A couple of shops. Huge quantities. And not only quantity, but quality. When the master of ceremonies turns to the bridegroom in verse 10, he says, everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then once everyone's had a bit too much to drink, they bring out the cheap rubbish. But you have saved the best until now. Now remember, the responsibility for providing this was the groom. The groom. It's his job to do this. He failed, but Jesus stepped in. And it's a picture of what's to come. When Jesus' hour does come, what does he do? Well, he steps in as the groom to a wedding. And he provides everything that's needed for the wedding, for his bride, the church. He provides everything that's needed. He saves the situation from shame, saves us from our shame, turns fear into joy, rescues lost people, turns round disaster into rejoicing, restores wholeness and happiness and joy where there was brokenness and despair. And that's the truth that this miracle points us to, that Jesus provides abundant help. Everything that we need, we find in Jesus. When his hour came, and it came at the end of John's gospel, he would step up. He wouldn't run away from what he knew was ahead. Outrageous grace, abundant provision, goodness overflowing. And verse 11, at the very end of our passage, we saw the response of those disciples. What did they respond? Verse 11, his disciples believed in him. I wonder what our response is today as we hear these stories of Jesus, as we think about knowing Jesus and making him known. Have we believed in him? Have we said, yes, I trust in you, Jesus? Have we done that? Jesus affirms ordinary things. Jesus involves the left out people. Jesus provides abundant help to meet our needs. This is the Jesus we make known. Not a Jesus who stamps out fun, who's only interested in obscure religious questions and frankly, sometimes obscure religious people, but a Jesus who is loving and generous and open-hearted and welcoming and the kind of person who provides this much wine for a party, inviting us this morning to come and receive, to receive the best, most satisfying, abundant, healthy, effective, grace-filled help that will meet our deepest needs, whatever those are, as we're sat here this morning, whatever our needs are, rescuing us from whatever mess we've got ourselves into because we forgot to plan for whatever it is we're doing, from our pride, from our attempts to save ourselves. The disciples responded by believing in Jesus. How are we going to respond today? If you want to pray with me or one of the deacons, please come and see us after the service. We'd be happy to do that. And maybe longer term, you're thinking, you know, I want to get more serious about knowing Jesus. I want to dig into this more in the months ahead. Well, we have a plan to start some small groups, life groups, we're going to call them, that will get together in people's houses and here at church and talk and pray and read together and grow together. If you're interested in being involved in one of those groups, come and see me or one of the deacons and we'll start getting those together in the weeks to come.